it. She never even dropped a curtsy when Rhett presented her with a red petticoat, and she never wore it, either. She kept Ella and Wade out of Rhett's way whenever she could, despite the fact that Wade adored Uncle Rhett, and Rhett was obviously fond of the boy. But instead of discharging Mammy, or being short and stern with her, Rhett treated her with the utmost deference, with far more courtesy than he treated any of the ladies of Scarlet's recent acquaintance. In fact, with more courtesy than he treated Scarlet herself. He always asked Mammy's permission to take Wade riding and consulted her before he bought Ella dolls. And Mammy was hardly polite to him. Scarlet felt that Rhett should be firm with Mammy, as became the head of the house. But Rhett only laughed and said that Mammy was the real head of the house. He infuriated Scarlet by saying coolly that he was preparing to be very sorry for her some years hence, when the Republican rule was gone from Georgia and the Democrats back in power. When the Democrats get a governor and a legislature of their own, all your new vulgar Republican friends will be wiped off the chessboard and sent back to minding bars and emptying slops where they belong. And you'll be left out on the end of a limb, with never a Democratic friend or a Republican either. Well, take no thought of the morrow. Scarlet laughed, and with some justice, for at that time Bullock was safe in the governor's chair. 27 Negroes were in the legislature, and thousands of the Democratic voters of Georgia were disfranchised. The Democrats will never get back. All they do is make the Yankees madder and put off the day when they could get back. All they do is talk big and run around at night, Ku Kluxing. They will get back. I know Southerners. I know Georgians. They're a tough and a bullheaded lot. If they've got to fight another war to get back, they'll fight another war. If they've got to buy black votes like the Yankees have done, they will buy black votes. If they've got to vote 10,000 dead men like the Yankees did, every corpse in every cemetery in Georgia will be at the polls. Things are going to get so bad under the benign rule of our good friend Rufus Bullock that Georgia is going to vomit him up. Rhett, don't use such vulgar words, cried Scarlet. You talk like I wouldn't be glad to see the Democrats come back. And you know that isn't so. I'd be very glad to see them back. Do you think I like to see these soldiers hanging around, reminding me of... Do you think I like... Well, I'm a Georgian, too. I'd like to see the Democrats get back. But they won't. Not ever. And even if they did, how would that affect my friends? They'd still have their money, wouldn't they?
If they kept their money. But I doubt the ability of any of them to keep money more than 5 years at the rate they're spending. Easy come, easy go. Their money won't do them any good. Any more than my money has done you any good. It certainly hasn't made a horse out of you yet, has it, my pretty mule?
The quarrel which sprang from this last remark lasted for days. After the fourth day of Scarlet's sulks and obvious silent demands for an apology, Rhett went to New Orleans, taking Wade with him, over Mammy's protests, and he stayed away until Scarlet's tantrum had passed. But the sting of not humbling him remained with her. When he came back from New Orleans, cool and bland, she swallowed her anger as best she could, pushing it into the back of her mind, to be thought of at some later date. She didn't want to bother with anything unpleasant now. She wanted to be happy, for her mind was full of the first party she would give in the new house. It would be an enormous night reception with palms and an orchestra and all the porches shrouded in canvas, and a collation that made her mouth water in anticipation. To it she intended to invite everyone she had ever known in Atlanta, all the old friends and all the new and charming ones she had met since returning from her honeymoon. The excitement of the party banished, for the most part, the memory of Rhett's barbs, and she was happy. Happier than she had been in years as she planned her reception. Oh, what fun it was to be rich! To give parties and never count the cost. To buy the most expensive furniture and dresses and food and never think about the bills. How marvelous to be able to send tidy checks to Aunt Pauline and Aunt Eulalie in Charleston and to Will at Tara. Oh, the jealous fools who said money wasn't everything. How perverse of Rhett to say that it had done nothing for her. Scarlett issued cards of invitation to all her friends and acquaintances, old and new, even those she didn't like. She didn't accept even Mrs. Merriweather, who had been almost rude when she called on her at the National Hotel, or Mrs. Elsing, who had been cool to frigidness. She invited Mrs. Meade and Mrs. Whiting, who she knew disliked her, and who she knew would be embarrassed because they didn't have the proper clothes to wear to so elegant a function. For Scarlett's housewarming, or crush, as it was fashionable to call such evening parties, half-reception, half-ball, was by far the most elaborate affair Atlanta had ever seen. That night the house and canvas-covered veranda were filled with guests who drank her champagne punch and ate her patties and creamed oysters and danced to the music of the orchestra that was carefully screened by a wall of palms and rubber plants. But none of those whom Rhett had termed the old guard were present, except Melanie and Ashley, Aunt Pitty and Uncle Henry, Dr. and Mrs. Meade and Grandpa Merriweather. Many of the old guard had reluctantly decided to attend the crush. Some had accepted because of Melanie's attitude. Others because they felt they owed Rhett a debt for saving their lives and those of their relatives. But 2 days before the function, a rumor went about Atlanta that Governor Bullock had been invited. The old guard signified their disapproval by a sheaf of cards, regretting their inability to accept Scarlett's kind invitation. And the small group of old friends who did attend took their departure, embarrassed but firm, as soon as the governor entered Scarlett's house. Scarlett was so bewildered and infuriated at these slights that the party was utterly ruined for her. Her elegant crush. She had planned it so lovingly, and so few old friends and no old enemies had been there to see how wonderful it was. After the last guest had gone home at dawn, she would have cried and stormed had she not been afraid that Rhett would roar with laughter, afraid that she would read, "I told you so," in his dancing black eyes, even if he didn't speak the words. So she swallowed her wrath with poor grace and pretended indifference. Only to Melanie, the next morning, did she permit herself the luxury of exploding. "You insulted me, Melly Wilkes, and you made Ashley and the others insult me. You know they'd never have gone home so soon if you hadn't dragged them. Oh, I saw you. Just when I started to bring Governor Bullock over to present him to you, you ran like a rabbit. I did not believe, I could not believe that he would really be present," answered Melanie unhappily, "even though everybody said..." "Everybody? So everybody's been clacking and blabbing about me, have they?" cried Scarlett furiously. "Do you mean to tell me that if you'd known the governor was going to be present, you wouldn't have come either?" "No," said Melanie in a low voice, her eyes on the floor. "Darling, I just couldn't have come." "Great balls of fire! So you'd have insulted me like everybody else did." "Oh, mercy," cried Melly in real distress. "I didn't mean to hurt you. You're my own sister, darling, and my own Charlie's widow, and I..." She put a timid hand on Scarlett's arm, but Scarlett flung it off, wishing fervently that she could roar as loudly as Gerald used to roar when in a temper. But Melanie faced her wrath. And as she looked into Scarlet's stormy green eyes, her slight shoulders straightened and a mantle of dignity, strangely at variance with her childish face and figure, fell upon her. "I'm sorry you are hurt, my dear. But I cannot meet Governor Bullock, or any Republican, or any scallywag. I will not meet them in your house or any other house. No, not even if I have to... If I have to..." Melanie cast about for the worst thing she could think of. "Not even if I have to be rude. Are you criticizing my friends?" "No, dear. But they are your friends and not mine." "Are you criticizing me for having the governor at my house?" Cornered, Melanie still met Scarlet's eyes unwaveringly. "Darling, what you always do for a good reason, and I love you and trust you. And it is not for me to criticize. And I will not permit anyone to criticize you in my hearing. But, oh, Scarlet!" Suddenly words began to bubble out, swift, hot words, and there was an inflexible hate in the low voice. "Can you forget what these people did to us? Can you forget darling Charlie dead and Ashley's health ruined and 12 Oaks burned? Oh, Scarlet, you can't forget that terrible man you shot with your mother's sewing box in his hands. You can't forget Sherman's men at Terra, and how they even stole our underwear and tried to burn the place down and actually handled my father's sword. Oh, Scarlet, it was these same people who robbed us and tortured us and left us to starve that you invited to your party. The same people who have set the darkies up to lord it over us, who are robbing us and keeping our men from voting. I can't forget. I won't forget. I won't let my beau forget. And I'll teach my grandchildren to hate these people, and my grandchildren's grandchildren, if God lets me live that long. Scarlet, how can you forget?" Melanie paused for breath, and Scarlet stared at her, startled out of her own anger by the quivering note of violence in Melanie's voice. "Do you think I'm a fool?" she questioned impatiently. "Of course I remember. But all that's past, Melly. It's up to us to make the best of things, and I'm trying to do it. Governor Bullock and some of the nicer Republicans can help us a lot if we handle them right." "There are no nice Republicans," said Melanie flatly. "And I don't want their help. And I don't intend to make the best of things, if they are Yankee things." "Good heaven, Melly! Why get in such a pet?" "Oh," cried Melanie, looking conscience-stricken. "How I have run on! Scarlet, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings or to criticize. Everybody thinks differently, and everybody's got a right to their own opinion. Now, dear, I love you, and you know I love you, and nothing you could ever do would make me change. And you still love me, don't you? I haven't made you hate me, have I? Scarlet, I couldn't stand it if anything ever came between us. After all we've been through together. Say it's all right." "Fiddly-dee, Melly, what a tempest you make in a teapot," said Scarlet grudgingly. But she didn't throw off the hand that stole around her waist. "Now, we're all right again," said Melanie pleasedly. But she added softly, "I want us to visit each other just like we always did, darling. Just, you let me know what days Republicans and scalawags are coming to see you, and I'll stay home on those days. It's a matter of supreme indifference to me whether you come or not," said Scarlet, putting on her bonnet and going home in a huff. There was some satisfaction to her wounded vanity in the hurt look on Melanie's face. In the weeks that followed her first party, Scarlet was hard put to keep up her pretense of supreme indifference to public opinion. When she didn't receive calls from old friends, except Melanie and Pitty and Uncle Henry and Ashley, and didn't get cards to their modest entertainments, she was genuinely puzzled and hurt. Had she not gone out of her way to bury old hatchets and show these people that she bore them no ill will for their gossiping and backbiting? Surely they must know that she didn't like Governor Bullock any more than they did, but that it was expedient to be nice to him. The idiots! If everybody would be nice to the Republicans, Georgia would get out of the fix she was in very quickly. She didn't realize then that with one stroke she had cut forever any fragile tie that still bound her to the old days, to old friends. Not even Melanie's influence could repair the break of that gossamer thread. And Melanie, bewildered, broken-hearted but still loyal, didn't try to repair it. Even had Scarlett wanted to turn back to old ways, old friends, there was no turning back possible now. The face of the town was set against her as stonily as granite. The hate that enveloped the Bullock regime enveloped her, too, a hate that had little fire and fury in it, but much cold implacability. Scarlett had cast her lot with the enemy, and whatever her birth and family connections, she was now in the category of a turncoat, a nigger lover, a traitor, a Republican, and a scalawag. After a miserable while, Scarlett's pretended indifference gave way to the real thing. She had never been one to worry long over the vagaries of human conduct, or to be cast down for long if one line of action failed. Soon she didn't care what the Merriweathers, the Elsings, the Whitings, the Bunnells, the Meads, and the others thought of her. At least Melanie called, bringing Ashley. And Ashley was the one who mattered the most. And there were other people in Atlanta who would come to her parties. Other people far more congenial than those hide-bound old hens. Any time she wanted to fill her house with guests, she could do so. And these guests would be far more entertaining, far more handsomely dressed than those prissy, straight-laced old fools who disapproved of her. These people were newcomers to Atlanta. Some of them were acquaintances of Rhett. Some associated with him in those mysterious affairs which he referred to as mere business, my pet. Some were couples Scarlett had met when she was living at the National Hotel, and some were Governor Bullock's appointees. The set with which she was now moving was a motley crew. Among them were the Gellerts, who had lived in a dozen different states, and who apparently had left each one hastily upon detection of their swindling schemes. The Conningtons, whose connection with the Freedmen's Bureau in a distant state had been highly lucrative at the expense of the ignorant blacks they were supposed to protect. The Deals, who had sold cardboard shoes to the Confederate government until it became necessary for them to spend the last year of the war in Europe. The Hundens, who had police records in many cities, but nevertheless were often successful bidders on state contracts. The Carahans, who had gotten their start in a gambling house, and now were gambling for bigger stakes in the building of non-existent railroads with the state's money. The Flahertys, who had bought salt at 1 cent a pound in 1861, and made a fortune when salt went to 50 cents in 1863. And the Barts, who had owned the largest brothel in a northern metropolis during the war, and now were moving in the best circles of carpetbagger society. Such people were Scarlett's intimates now. But those who attended her larger receptions included others of some culture and refinement, many of excellent families. In addition to the carpetbag gentry, substantial people from the North were moving into Atlanta. Attracted by the never-ceasing business activity of the town in this period of rebuilding and expansion, Yankee families of wealth sent young sons to the South to pioneer on the new frontier. and Yankee officers, after their discharge, took up permanent residence in the town they had fought so hard to capture. At first, strangers in a strange town, they were glad to accept invitations to the lavish entertainments of the wealthy and hospitable Mrs. Butler. But they soon drifted out of her set. They were good people, and they needed only a short acquaintance with carpetbaggers and carpetbag rule to become as resentful of them as the native Georgians were. Many became Democrats and more Southern than the Southerners. Other misfits in Scarlet Circle remained there only because they were not welcome elsewhere. They would have much preferred the quiet parlors of the old guard, but the old guard would have none of them. Among these were the Yankee schoolmarms who had come south imbued with a desire to uplift the Negro, and the scalawags who had been born good Democrats, but had turned Republican after the surrender. It was hard to say which class was more cordially hated by the settled citizenry, the impractical Yankee schoolmarms or the scalawags, but the balance probably fell with the latter. The schoolmarms could be dismissed with, "Well, what can you expect of nigger-loving Yankees? Of course they think the nigger is just as good as they are." But for those Georgians who had turned Republican for personal gain, there was no excuse. "Starving is good enough for us. It ought to be good enough for you," was the way the old guard felt. Many ex-Confederate soldiers, knowing the frantic fear of men who saw their families in want, were more tolerant of former comrades who had changed political colors in order that their families might eat. But not the women of the old guard. And the women were the implacable and inflexible power behind the social throne. The lost cause was stronger, dearer now in their hearts than it had ever been at the height of its glory. It was a fetish now. Everything about it was sacred. The graves of the men who had died for it, the battlefields, the torn flags, the crossed sabers in their halls, the fading letters from the front, the veterans. These women gave no aid, comfort, or quarter to the late enemy. And now Scarlet was numbered among the enemy. In this mongrel society thrown together by the exigencies of the political situation, there was but one thing in common. That was money. As most of them had never had $25 at one time in their whole lives, previous to the war, they were now embarked on an orgy of spending such as Atlanta had never seen before. With the Republicans in the political saddle, the town entered into an era of waste and ostentation, with the trappings of refinement thinly veneering the vice and vulgarity beneath. Never before had the cleavage of the very rich and the very poor been so marked. Those on top took no thought for those less fortunate. Except for the Negroes, of course. They must have the very best. The best of schools and lodgings and clothes and amusements, for they were the power in politics, and every Negro vote counted. But as for the recently impoverished Atlanta people, they could starve and drop in the streets for all the newly rich Republicans cared. On the crest of this wave of vulgarity, Scarlet rode triumphantly, newly a bride, dashingly pretty in her fine clothes, with Rhett's money solidly behind her. It was an era that suited her. Crude, garish, showy, full of overdressed women, overfurnished houses, too many jewels, too many horses, too much food, too much whiskey. When Scarlet infrequently stopped to think about the matter, she knew that none of her new associates could be called ladies, by Ellen's strict standards. But she had broken with Ellen's standards too many times since that faraway day, when she stood in the parlor at Tara and decided to be Rhett's mistress. And she didn't often feel the bite of conscience now. Perhaps these new friends were not, strictly speaking, ladies and gentlemen. But like Rhett's New Orleans friends, They were so much fun. So very much more fun than the subdued church-going, Shakespeare-reading friends of her earlier Atlanta days. And except for her brief honeymoon interlude, she had not had fun in so long. Nor had she had any sense of security. Now secure, she wanted to dance, to play, to riot, to gorge on foods and fine wine, to deck herself in silks and satins, to wallow on soft feather beds and fine upholstery. And she did all these things. Encouraged now by Rhett's amused tolerance, freed now from the restraints of her childhood, freed even from that last fear of poverty, she was permitting herself the luxury she had often dreamed, of doing exactly what she pleased, and telling people who didn't like it to go to hell. To her had come that pleasant intoxication, peculiar to those whose lives are a deliberate slap in the face of organized society. The gambler, the confidence man, the polite adventuress, all those who succeed by their wits. She said and did exactly what she pleased, and in practically no time. Her insolence knew no bounds. She didn't hesitate to display arrogance to her new Republican and scalawag friends, but to no class was she ruder or more insolent than the Yankee officers of the garrison and their families. Of all the heterogeneous mass of people who had poured into Atlanta, the army people alone she refused to receive or tolerate. She even went out of her way to be bad-mannered to them. Melanie was not alone in being unable to forget what a blue uniform meant. To Scarlet, that uniform and those gold buttons would always mean the fears of the siege, the terror of flight, the looting and burning, the desperate poverty, and the grinding work at Terra. Now that she was rich and secure in the friendship of the governor and many prominent Republicans, she could be insulting to every blue uniform she saw. And she was insulting. Rhett once lazily pointed out to her that most of the male guests who assembled under their roof had worn that same blue uniform not so long ago. But she retorted that a Yankee didn't seem like a Yankee unless he had on a blue uniform. To which Rhett replied, "Consistency, thou art a jewel," and shrugged. Scarlet, hating the bright, hard blue they wore, enjoyed snubbing them all the more because it so bewildered them. The garrison families had a right to be bewildered, for most of them were quiet, well-bred folk, lonely in a hostile land, anxious to go home to the north, a little ashamed of the riffraff whose rule they were forced to uphold. An infinitely better class than that of Scarlet's associates. Naturally, the officers' wives were puzzled that the dashing Mrs. Butler took to her bosom such women as the common red-haired Bridget Flaherty, and went out of her way to slight them. But even the ladies whom Scarlet took to her bosom had to endure much from her. However, they did it gladly. To them she not only represented wealth and elegance, but the old regime, with its old names, old families, old traditions with which they wished ardently to identify themselves. The old families they yearned after might have cast Scarlet out, but the ladies of the new aristocracy didn't know it. They only knew that Scarlet's father had been a great slave owner, her mother a Robillard of Savannah, and her husband was Rhett Butler of Charleston, and this was enough for them. She was their opening wedge into the old society they wished to enter, the society which scorned them, would not return calls, and bowed frigidly in churches. In fact, she was more than their wedge into society. To them, fresh from obscure beginnings, she was society. Pinchbeck ladies themselves. They no more saw through Scarlet's pinchbeck pretensions than she herself did. They took her at her own valuation and endured much at her hands, her airs, her graces, her tempers, her arrogance, her downright rudeness, and her frankness about their shortcomings. They were so lately come from nothing, and so uncertain of themselves, that they were doubly anxious to appear refined, and feared to show their temper or make retorts in kind, lest they be considered unladylike. At all costs, they must be ladies. They pretended to great delicacy, modesty, and innocence. To hear them talk, one would have thought they had no legs, natural functions, or knowledge of the wicked world. No one would have thought that red-haired Bridget Flaherty, who had a sun-defying white skin and a brogue that could be cut with a butter knife, had stolen her father's hidden hoard to come to America to be chambermaid in a New York hotel. And to observe the delicate vapors of Sylvia, formerly Sadie Bell, Connington, and Mamie Bart, no one would have suspected that the first grew up above her father's saloon in the Bowery and waited on the bar at rush times, and that the latter, so it was said, had come out of one of her husband's own brothels. No, they were delicate, sheltered creatures now. The men, though they had made money, learned new ways less easily or were, perhaps, less patient with the demands of the new gentility. They drank heavily at Scarlett's parties, far too heavily. And usually after a reception, there were one or more unexpected guests who stayed the night. They didn't drink like the men of Scarlett's girlhood. They became sodden, stupid, ugly, or obscene. Moreover, no matter how many spittoons she might put out in plain view, the rugs always showed signs of tobacco juice on the mornings after. She had a contempt for these people, but she enjoyed them. Because she enjoyed them, she filled the house with them. And because of her contempt, she told them to go to hell as often as they annoyed her. But they stood it. They even stood for Rhett, a more difficult matter. For Rhett saw through them, and they knew it. He had no hesitation about stripping them verbally, even under his own roof, always in a manner that left them no reply. Unashamed of how he came by his fortune, he pretended that they, too, were unashamed of their beginnings, and he seldom missed an opportunity to remark upon matters which, by common consent, everyone felt were better left in polite obscurity. There was never any knowing when he would remark affably over a punch cup, "Ralph, if I'd had any sense, I'd have made my money selling gold mine stocks to widows and orphans like you instead of blockading. It's so much safer." "Well, Bill, I see you have a new span of horses. Been selling a few thousand more bonds for non-existent railroads? Good work, boy. Congratulations, Amos, on landing that state contract. Too bad you had to grease so many palms to get it." The ladies felt that he was odiously, unendurably vulgar. The men said behind his back that he was a swine and a bastard. New Atlanta liked Rhett no better than old Atlanta had done, and he made as little attempt to conciliate the one as he had the other. He went his way, amused, contemptuous, impervious to the opinions of those about him, so courteous that his courtesy was an affront in itself. To Scarlett, he was still an enigma, but an enigma about which she no longer bothered her head. She was convinced that nothing ever pleased him or ever would please him, that he either wanted something badly and didn't have it, or never had wanted anything and so didn't care about anything. He laughed at everything she did, encouraged her extravagances and insolences, jeered at her pretenses, and paid the bills. Chapter 50. Rhett never deviated from his smooth, imperturbable manners, even in their most intimate moments. But Scarlett never lost the old feeling that he was watching her covertly, knew that if she turned her head suddenly, she would surprise in his eyes that speculative, waiting look, that look of almost terrible patience that she did not understand. Sometimes he was a very comfortable person to live with, for all his unfortunate habit of not permitting anyone in his presence to act a lie, palm off a pretense, or indulge in bombast. He listened to her talk of the store and the mills and the saloon, the convicts and the cost of feeding them, and gave shrewd, hard-headed advice. He had untiring energy for the dancing and parties she loved, and an unending supply of coarse stories, with which he regaled her on their infrequent evenings alone, when the table was cleared and brandy and coffee before them. She found that he would give her anything she desired, answer any question she asked as long as she was forthright, and refuse her anything she attempted to gain by indirection, hints, and feminine angling. He had a disconcerting habit of seeing through her and laughing rudely. Contemplating the suave indifference with which he generally treated her, Scarlett frequently wondered, but with no real curiosity, why he had married her. Men married for love or a home and children or money, but she knew he had married her for none of these things. He certainly didn't love her. He referred to her lovely house as an architectural horror, and said he would rather live in a well-regulated hotel than a home. And he never once hinted about children, as Charles and Frank had done. Once, when trying to coquette with him, she asked him why he married her, and was infuriated when he replied with an amused gleam in his eye, "I married you to keep you for a pet, my dear." No. He hadn't married her for any of the usual reasons men marry women. He had married her solely because he wanted her, and couldn't get her any other way. He had admitted as much the night he proposed to her. He had wanted her, just as he had wanted Belle Watling. This was not a pleasant thought. In fact, it was a barefaced insult. But she shrugged it off, as she had learned to shrug off all unpleasant facts. They had made a bargain, and she was quite pleased with her side of the bargain. She hoped he was equally pleased, but she didn't care very much whether he was or not. But one afternoon, when she was consulting Dr. Mead about a digestive upset, she learned an unpleasant fact which she couldn't shrug off. It was with real hate in her eyes that she stormed into her bedroom at twilight and told Rhett that she was going to have a baby. He was lounging in a silk dressing gown in a cloud of smoke, and his eyes went sharply to her face as she spoke, but he said nothing. He watched her in silence, but there was a tenseness about his pose, as he waited for her next words, that was lost on her. Indignation and despair had claimed her to the exclusion of all other thoughts. "You know I don't want any more children. I never wanted any at all. Every time things are going right with me, I have to have a baby. Oh, don't sit there and laugh. You don't want it either. Oh, Mother of God!" If he was waiting for words from her, these were not the words he wanted. His face hardened slightly, and his eyes became blank. "Well, why not give it to Miss Mellie? Didn't you tell me she was so misguided as to want another baby?"
"Oh, I could kill you. I won't have it, I tell you, I won't."
"No. Pray continue."
"Oh, there are things to do. I'm not the stupid country fool I used to be. Now I know that a woman doesn't have to have children if she doesn't want them. There are things."
He was on his feet and had her by the wrist, and there was a hard, driving fear in his face. "Scarlett, you fool, tell me the truth. You haven't done anything."
"No, I haven't, but I'm going to. Do you think I'm going to have my figure ruined all over again just when I've got my waistline down and I'm having a good time? Where did you get this idea? Who's been telling you things? Maybe Bart. She... The madam of a whorehouse would know such tricks. That woman never puts foot in this house again, do you understand? After all, it's my house and I'm the master of it. I do not even want you to speak to her again.
Oh, do as I please. Turn me loose. Why should you care?
I don't care whether you have one child or 20, but I do care if you die.
Die? Me?
Yes, die. I don't suppose Mamie Bart told you the chances a woman takes when she does a thing like that.
No, said Scarlet reluctantly. She just said it would fix things up fine.
By God, I will kill her, cried Rhett, and his face was black with rage. He looked down into Scarlet's tear-stained face, and some of the wrath faded, but it was still hard and set. Suddenly he picked her up in his arms and sat down in the chair, holding her close to him tightly as if he feared she would get away from him. Listen, my baby. I won't have you take your life in your hands. Do you hear? Good God, I don't want children any more than you do, but I can support them. I don't want to hear any more foolishness out of you, and if you dare try to... Scarlet, I saw a girl die that way once. She was only a... Well, but she was a pretty good sort at that. It's not an easy way to die.
Well, Rhett, she cried, startled out of her misery at the emotion in his voice. She had never seen him so moved. Where? Who?
In New Orleans. Oh, years ago. I was young and impressionable. He bent his head suddenly and buried his lips in her hair. You'll have your baby, Scarlet. If I have to handcuff you to my wrist for the next 9 months.
She sat up in his lap and stared into his face with frank curiosity. Under her gaze it was suddenly smooth and bland, as though wiped clear by magic. His eyebrows were up, and the corner of his mouth was down. "Do I mean so much to you?" she questioned, dropping her eyelids. He gave her a level look, as though estimating how much coquetry was behind the question. Reading the true meaning of her demeanor, he made casual answer.
Well, yes. You see, I've invested a good deal of money in you, and I'd hate to lose it.
Melanie came out of Scarlet's room, weary from the strain, but happy to tears at the birth of Scarlet's daughter. Rhett stood tensely in the hall, surrounded by cigar butts, which had burned holes in the fine carpet. "You can go in now, Captain Butler," she said shyly. Rhett went swiftly past her into the room, and Melanie had a brief glimpse of him bending over the small naked baby in Mammy's lap before Dr. Mead shut the door. Melanie sank into a chair, her face pinkening with embarrassment that she had unintentionally witnessed so intimate a scene. "Ah," she thought, "how sweet, how worried poor Captain Butler has been. And he didn't take a single drink all this time. How nice of him. So many gentlemen are so intoxicated by the time their babies are born. I fear he needs a drink badly. Dare I suggest it? No, that would be very forward of me." She sank gratefully into a chair, her back, which always ached these days, feeling as though it would break in two at the waistline. Oh, how fortunate Scarlet was to have Captain Butler just outside her door while the baby was being born. If only she had had Ashley with her that dreadful day Beau came, she wouldn't have suffered half so much. If only that small girl behind those closed doors were hers, and not Scarlet's. Oh, how wicked I am, she thought guiltily. I am coveting her baby, and Scarlet has been so good to me. Forgive me, Lord. I wouldn't really want Scarlet's baby, but I would so like a baby of my own. She pushed a small cushion behind her aching back and thought hungrily of a daughter of her own. But Dr. Meade had never changed his opinion on that subject. And though she was quite willing to risk her life for another child, Ashley would not hear of it. A daughter. How Ashley would love a daughter. A daughter? Mercy! She sat up in alarm. I never told Captain Butler it was a girl. And of course he was expecting a boy. Oh, how dreadful! Melanie knew that to a woman, a child of either sex was equally welcome. But to a man, and especially such a self-willed man as Captain Butler, a girl would be a blow. A reflection upon his manhood. Oh, how thankful she was that God had permitted her only child to be a boy. She knew that, had she been the wife of the fearsome Captain Butler, she would have thankfully died in childbirth, rather than present him with a daughter as his firstborn. But Mammy, waddling grinning from the room, set her mind at ease, and at the same time made her wonder just what kind of a man Captain Butler really was.
"When I was bathing that child just now," said Mammy, "I kind of apologized to Mr. Rhett about it not being a boy. But Lord, Miss Melly, you know what he say? He say, 'Hush your mouth, Mammy. Who want a boy? Boys ain't no fun. They's just a passel of trouble. Gals is what is fun. I wouldn't swap this yere gal for a baker's dozen of boys.' Then he try to snatch the child from me, buck naked as she was, and I slap his wrist and say, 'Behave yourself, Mr. Rhett. I'll just bide my time till you gets a boy, and then I'll laugh out loud to hear you holler for joy.' He grin and shake his head and say, 'Mammy, you is a fool. Boys ain't no use to nobody.' Ain't I proof of that? Yes'm, Miss Melly, he act like a gentleman about it," finished Mammy graciously.
It was not lost on Melanie that Rhett's conduct had gone far toward redeeming him in Mammy's eyes.
"Maybe I'd done been a mite wrong about Mr. Rhett. This sure is a happy day to me, Miss Melly. I done died for 3 generations of Robillard gals, and it sure is a happy day."
"Oh, yes, it is a happy day, Mammy. The happiest days are the days when babies come." To one person in the house, it was not a happy day. Scolded and for the most part ignored, Wade Hampton idled miserably about the dining room. Early that morning, Mammy had waked him abruptly, dressed him hurriedly, and sent him with Ella to Aunt Pitty's house for breakfast. The only explanation he received was that his mother was sick, and the noise of his playing might upset her. Aunt Pitty's house was in an uproar, for the news of Scarlet's sickness had sent the old lady to bed in a state with Cookie in attendance. And breakfast was a scant meal that Peter concocted for the children. As the morning wore on, fear began to possess Wade's soul. Suppose Mother died? Other boys' mothers had died. He had seen the hearses move away from the houses and heard his small friend sobbing. Suppose Mother should die? Wade loved his mother very much, almost as much as he feared her. And the thought of her being carried away in a black hearse behind black horses with plumes on their bridles made his small chest ache so that he could hardly breathe. When noon came, and Peter was busy in the kitchen, Wade slipped out the front door and hurried home as fast as his short legs could carry him, fear speeding him. Uncle Rhett or Aunt Melly or Mammy surely would tell him the truth. But Uncle Rhett and Aunt Melly were not to be seen, and Mammy and Dilsey sped up and down the back stairs with towels and basins of hot water and didn't notice him in the front hall. From upstairs he could hear occasionally the curt tones of Dr. Meade whenever a door opened. Once he heard his mother groan, and he burst into sobbing hiccups. He knew she was going to die. For comfort,
He made overtures to the honey-colored cat which lay on the sunny windowsill in the front hall. But Tom, full of years and irritable at disturbances, switched his tail and spat softly. Finally, Mammy, coming down the front stairs, her apron rumpled and spotted, her head rag awry, saw him and scowled. Mammy had always been Wade's mainstay, and her frown made him tremble.
"You is de worstest boy I ever seed," she said. "Ain't I done sent you to Miss Pitty's? Gwan back dar."
"Is mother going to... will she die?"
"You is de troublesomest child I ever seed. Die? God almighty, no. Lord, boys is a torment. I don't see why the Lord send boys to folks. Now gwan way from here."
But Wade did not go. He retreated behind the portières in the hall, only half convinced by her words. The remark about the troublesomeness of boys stung, for he had always tried his best to be good. Aunt Melly hurried down the stairs half an hour later, pale and tired, but smiling to herself. She looked thunderstruck when she saw his woe-begone face in the shadows of the drapery. Usually Aunt Melly had all the time in the world to give him. She never said, as Mother so often did, "Don't bother me now, I'm in a hurry," or "Run away, Wade, I'm busy." But this morning she said, "Wade, you've been very naughty. Why didn't you stay at Aunt Pitty's?"
"Is Mother going to die?"
"Gracious, no, Wade! Don't be a silly child."
And then, relenting, "Dr. Meade has just brought her a nice little baby. A sweet little sister for you to play with. And if you're real good, you can see her tonight. Now run out and play, and don't make any noise." Wade slipped into the quiet dining room, his small and insecure world tottering. Was there no place for a worried little 7-year-old boy on this sunshiny day when the grown-ups acted so curiously? He sat down on the windowsill in the alcove and nibbled a bit of the elephant's ear, which grew in a box in the sun. It was so peppery that it stung his eyes to tears, and he began to cry. Mother was probably dying. Nobody paid him any heed. And one and all they rushed about because of a new baby. A girl baby. Wade had little interest in babies, still less in girls. The only little girl he knew intimately was Ella, and so far, she had done nothing to command his respect or liking. After a long interval, Dr. Meade and Uncle Rhett came down the stairs and stood talking in the hall in low voices. After the door shut behind the doctor, Uncle Rhett came swiftly into the dining room and poured himself a large drink from the decanter before he saw Wade. Wade shrank back, expecting to be told again that he was naughty and must return to Aunt Pitty's, but instead, Uncle Rhett smiled. Wade had never seen him smile like that, or look so happy and encouraged. He leaped from the sill and ran to him.
"You've got a sister," said Rhett, squeezing him. "By God, the most beautiful baby you ever saw. Now, why are you crying?"
"Mother."
"Your mother's eating a great big dinner, chicken and rice and gravy and coffee, and we're going to make her some ice cream in a little while. And you can have 2 plates if you want them. And I'll show you your sister, too."
Weak with relief, Wade tried to be polite about his new sister, but failed. Everyone was interested in this girl. No one cared anything about him anymore, not even Aunt Melly or Uncle Rhett.
"Uncle Rhett," he began, "do people like girls better than boys?"
Rhett set down his glass and looked sharply into the small face, and instant comprehension came into his eyes.
"No, I can't say they do," he answered seriously, as though giving the matter due thought.
It's just that girls are more trouble than boys. And people are apt to worry more about troublesome people than those who aren't.
Mammy said boys were troublesome.
Well, Mammy was upset. She didn't mean it.
Uncle Rhett, wouldn't you rather have had a little boy than a little girl? Questioned Wade hopefully.
No, answered Rhett swiftly. And seeing the boy's face fall, he continued, Now why should I want a boy when I've already got one?
You have, cried Wade, his mouth falling open at this information. Where is he?
Right here, answered Rhett, and picking the child up, drew him to his knee. You're boy enough for me, son.
For a moment, the security and happiness of being wanted was so great that Wade almost cried again. His throat worked, and he ducked his head against Rhett's waistcoat.
You are my boy, aren't you?
Can you be, well, two men's boy? Questioned Wade, loyalty to the father he had never known, struggling with love for the man who held him so understandingly.
Yes, said Rhett firmly. Just like you can be your mother's boy and Aunt Mellie's, too.
Wade digested this statement. It made sense to him, and he smiled and wriggled against Rhett's arm shyly.
You understand little boys, don't you, Uncle Rhett?
Rhett's dark face fell into its old harsh lines, and his lip twisted.
Yes, he said bitterly. I understand, little boys.
For a moment, fear came back to Wade, fear and a sudden sense of jealousy. Uncle Rhett wasn't thinking of him, but of someone else.
You haven't got any other little boys, have you?
Rhett set him on his feet.
I'm going to have a drink, and so are you, Wade. Your first drink. A toast to your new sister.
You haven't got any other, began Wade.
And then seeing Rhett reach for the decanter of claret, the excitement at being included in this grown-up ceremony diverted him.
Oh, I can't, Uncle Rhett. I promised Aunt Mellie I wouldn't drink till I graduated from the university, and she's going to give me a watch if I don't.
And I'll give you a chain for it, this one I'm wearing now, if you want it, said Rhett. And he was smiling again. Aunt Mellie's quite right. But she was talking about spirits, not wine. You must learn to drink wine like a gentleman, son. And there's no time like the present to learn.
Skillfully, he diluted the claret with water from the carafe until the liquid was barely pink, and handed the glass to Wade. At that moment, Mammy entered the dining room. She had changed to her best Sunday black, and her apron and head rag were fresh and crisp. As she waddled, she switched herself, and from her skirts came the whisper and rustle of silk. The worried look had gone from her face, and her almost toothless gums showed in a wide smile.
"Birthday gift, Mr. Rhett," she said.
Wade stopped with his glass at his lips. He knew Mammy had never liked his stepfather. He had never heard her call him anything except Captain Butler. And her conduct toward him had been dignified but cold. And here she was beaming and sidling and calling him Mr. Rhett. What a topsy-turvy day!
You'd rather have rum than claret, I suppose, said Rhett, reaching into the cellarette and producing a squat bottle. She is a beautiful baby, isn't she, Mammy?
She sure is,
answered Mammy, smacking her lips as she took the glass.
Did you ever see a prettier one?
Well, sir, Miss Scarlet was mighty nice pretty when she come out, but not quite.
Have another glass, Mammy. And Mammy.
His tone was stern, but his eyes twinkled. What's that rustling noise I hear?
Lord, Mr. Rhett, that ain't nothing but my red silk petticoat,
Mammy giggled.
and switched till her huge bulk shook.
"Nothing but your petticoat. I don't believe it.
You sound like a peck of dried leaves rubbing together. Let me see. Pull up your skirt.
Mr. Rhett, you is bad. Yay, oh, Lord!"
Mammy gave a little shriek and retreated. And from a distance of a yard, modestly elevated her dress a few inches.